From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. For 35 years, the Reverend Theodore Hesburgh had a job that combined politics, religion, public relations, big business, and football. Hesburgh was president of Notre Dame University. On this edition of Fresh Air, Theodore Hesburgh on God, country, and Notre Dame. Also, actress Billy Whitelaw joins us from London to discuss her starring role in the new film The Craze as the mother of twin gangsters, and to talk with us about her collaborative relationship with the late playwright Samuel Beckett. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new special that tests your knowledge of the tube. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. On the eve of the next round of voting for leadership of the Conservative Party in Great Britain, none of the three candidates looks as if he can gain a majority of the Tory members of Parliament. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from London.
To win, either former Defense Secretary Michael Heseltine or the current Chancellor of the Exchequer John Major or the current Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd has to win 187 of the 372 votes of the Conservative members of the House of Commons. They and they only will vote tomorrow on who will become Britain's next Prime Minister, and they seem to be well divided amongst the three candidates. Politicking and maneuvering has been underway at a furious pace, and it looks as though John Major, the personal choice of outgoing Prime Minister Thatcher, may lead after tomorrow's vote, but will probably fall short of an outright majority. The third and final ballot occurs on Thursday, and because of a complex set of rules involving first and second preferences, there is no predicting who could take it all. The new Prime Minister would then have another year and a half before he is required to call a general election and go before the people against the opposition Labour Party. I'm Mike Schuster in London.
President Bush is conferring with President Carlos Salinas de Gortari today in Mexico as the two leaders try to pave the way for a free trade agreement. Presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the talks will focus on an open trade agreement similar to that signed with Canada in 1988. Tomorrow's schedule calls for the two presidents to meet in the Mexican Industrial Center of Monterrey, where Mr. Bush is to address business leaders. The Bush administration has asked Congress for the authority to hold formal trade talks with Mexico early next year. Firefighters now believe they have the upper hand in controlling a fire burning four large tanks of jet fuel at Denver's Stapleton International Airport. Mark Roberts reports.
The two jet fuel tanks that first burned now look like crumpled, blackened marshmallows. Two even larger fuel tanks continue to burn. Denver Fire Chief Rich Gonzalez says firefighters will keep pouring water on the tanks to keep the fire from spreading.
The strategy is, of course, to maintain cooling the two original tanks to make sure that we keep that temperature below the flash point of the fuel and to continue to cool the two larger tanks while it burns off its supply.
Firefighters say it will be one or two more days before this fire burns out. It could be a month, they say, before investigators determine the cause of the blaze. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Roberts at Stapleton Airport in Denver.
Soviet President Gorbachev has issued his country's toughest warning yet against the Iraqi occupation of Kuwait. He told Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz that Iraq will face a UN resolution authorizing force if it doesn't withdraw its troops from Kuwait and release all hostages. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 6 points today to close at 2,533.17. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Nation magazine once called my guest, the Reverend Theodore Hesburgh, the most influential cleric in America. Hesburgh was only 35 years old when he was appointed president of Notre Dame University. He served an unusually long tenure, 35 years. Hesburgh prides himself on being one of the few university presidents who outlasted the student protests of the 60s. But although Hesburgh often disapproved of his students' tactics, he opposed the war in Vietnam. Throughout his tenure at Notre Dame, he remained politically active, serving on 14 presidential commissions. He chaired the Commission on Civil Rights and the Select Commission on Immigration and Refugee Policy, and served as the Vatican's representative to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Since his retirement in 1987, Hesburgh has been the president emeritus of Notre Dame. He's written a new autobiography called God, Country, Notre Dame. Since Hesburgh was in the peace movement during the Vietnam War, I asked him his thoughts on the Bush administration's current actions in the Gulf.
Well, I think the president did the right thing in getting armed forces and from a number of countries into the Gulf when this thing began. I lived in Europe at the time of Hitler, and I had the impression that if Hitler had been confronted at Munich in 1939 and told, look, you've gone as far as you're going, one more step and you're in real trouble and the whole world's going to be against you, we might have stopped the war that brought on the killing of 50 million people. I think this guy had to be stopped. Now I think we've made enough. We're in a kind of a poker game now. We put in 200, he puts in 250 new men. And I think now is the time to negotiate. So I think the president was right in doing what he did. He was right in getting a world coalition against him. I think he would be right now in getting a very sharp negotiator in there and not just go on playing poker. We put in 200, you put in 250, we put in 300, et cetera.
Do you think he'd be justified in going to war, President Bush?
I don't think anybody wants to go to war. You don't solve anything, really, by violence. A lot of misery. You'll probably lose the allies that are with us. Even the Russians don't want to go to war, and we always think of them as being very macho. And I don't think the French want to go to war, and certainly the Arabs feel uneasy shooting at their own brethren. There's a time for a show of force to show you're serious, then there's a time for negotiation. I think there's never a reasonable time for war, hardly ever.
What would you like to see the church do now?
Well, I think it's inevitable that the main churches in America, the Protestant, the Catholic churches, will inevitably be for nonviolence because they go along with what I said earlier, that you don't really solve things by violence. You just commit destruction and death and suffering and all the rest. I think the churches are in a good position to mediate. And on the other hand, the churches didn't do very much when World War II was coming on, not as much as they should, I think, to influence governments to talk instead of start shooting. But there's a time when with a tyrant and with an unjust tyrant and a braggadocio tyrant, you simply have to say, you aren't going to get away with this. Now, we've got plenty of ways of stopping you, but we don't want to hurt your people, so either we're going to have a conversation or a war. A conversation would be much better, and it would get us further. I think the churches are promoting that stance.
Father Theodore Hesburgh is my guest, and he's written a new memoir, which is called God, Country, Notre Dame. When you were getting started, did you see yourself as apt to live the life of a parish priest, or did you think that you would be heading up an organization or, you know, let alone a large university?
Terry, it was a curious kind of thing. I joined a religious order, and I took the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Now, the toughest of those is obedience, because you do what you're told to do, like in the Marines. You don't solve your problems your own personal life. Well, they asked me first, did I want to go out and get a doctorate in theology? And I said, not really. I'd like to be a chaplain in the Navy. The war was on. And they said, well, go out and get a doctorate in theology. So I did it quickly. I cut a year off the three-year program, and I'd already had 4 years of theology. And when I finished, again, I went and said, they said, well, would you like to go on active work or to teach? And I said, I'd rather go on active pastoral work. I still would like to be a chaplain of the Navy. There's still a war going on. And they told me to go teach at Notre Dame, 1945. They were probably right because the war was over before I got through the first semester of teaching. But then I got to love teaching, and, of course, I've always loved theology. And then one day the president at that point, my predecessor, a fellow named Father John Cavanaugh, said, Ted, how would you like to get into administration? And I said, that's the last thing in the world I want to do. I didn't really want to teach, but now I love teaching. I love working with the students and having all these different clubs and activities going on, and I'm writing a book on theology for college students, and I think I'm doing pretty well, so why don't you leave me alone? Well, the next year I was made executive vice president, and 3 years later president. So I didn't foresee any of that, to answer your question. In fact, I resisted it.
One of the things you did early on when you took over at Notre Dame was to change the board from a clerical board to a lay board. What were some of the restrictions set down by the Vatican that you didn't think the university should have to follow?
Well, the problem is that a university needs above all what I call academic freedom. It has to be It lives in a world of ideas, and it has to be free to challenge ideas, and it has to be challenge a few sacred cows. And I had come into one circumstance where we were publishing a book I suppose, Church and State, and I thought it was a good book. And one of the cardinals in the Vatican thought it was not a good book because it was against what he had been saying in a book he had written. So they said, you shouldn't publish that book. And I said, we're a university, we have academic freedom, and we're going to publish it. So then, of course, he called up my boss, who lived in Rome, and said, tell him to quiet down. And I just told my boss the same thing, that if he wanted to fire me, that was his privilege. But as long as I was president, there was going to be academic freedom in this university. And the only way they were going to change me on this was to remove me. Well, they didn't remove me. The book sold out, 6,000 copies, and everybody was reasonably happy. But it struck me at that point that an organization as big as a Catholic university, which is totally faithful to the church and wants to go on and be a Catholic university, needs a lot of elbow room, and I thought we'd have more elbow room if we were run by lay people. So what we did, we simply set up a board of trustees who had been advisors to the university, 50 of them from all parts of the country and overseas, some Protestants as well as Catholics, Jews, black and white, Hispanic. We tried to get a composite board that was mainly Catholic, mainly Notre Dame alumni, but did have a flavor of what the United States was like. And we simply put it to the order that we should turn the whole place, worth over $1 billion, over to this board to govern. And I think it's worked very, very well. In fact, practically every university, every Catholic hospital, now many Catholic parochial schools are going this route.
My guest is Father Theodore Hesburgh, and he's written a new autobiography, which is called God, Country, Notre Dame. And he was the president of Notre Dame University for 35 years. He retired in 1987. You were president of Notre Dame during one of the most difficult periods for university presidents, and I'm thinking of the student protests of the late 1960s. You decided that you really needed to draw the line and hold the line. Of course, you had to decide where you were going to draw the line. You issued a statement to the students saying that anyone or any group that substitutes force for rational persuasion, be it violent or nonviolent, will be given 15 minutes of meditation to cease and desist. And if they didn't cease and desist, then what?
Then they got suspended from the university for that particular semester. Now, then we gave them 5 minutes more to think about it some more and said, if you're still impeding the rights of other people or blocking the normal life of the university and education, we are going to be expelled from the university for good. Now, after I said that, one group of a dozen youngsters came to see me the night before, and they said, we don't like the fact that their youngsters in the next 3 days are going to be going in to look for jobs in CIA or Dow Chemical. And I said, well, you've got a right to run up and down and carry your signs and do whatever you want to try to persuade them not to do that. But if they want to do it, that's their right. They're free and you're free, and I've got to protect both the freedom, your freedom and their freedom. Well, as a matter of fact, they went and lay down in front of the door going into the interview room, and I told them, that is not physical violence, but it's moral violence. Nobody's going to walk on your bodies to get into an office. I wouldn't walk on them to get into my office. So you got 15 minutes to cease and desist and get out of here and pick up your ID cards right now. Well, they were still there 15 minutes later, and the dean of students said, okay, you're out for the semester. Now we're down to the short strokes. You got 5 minutes more, and if you're still here doing this, blocking the rights of others in this fashion, 5 minutes from now, you're going to be out of the university for good. Well, when he came back in 5 minutes, they were gone, and that was the end of the test.
So those students were expelled? Suspended?
For the semester. Yeah. They all graduated. They came back the next semester and made up their work.
How did you decide where to draw the line?
It seemed to me, Terry, that in a university, you've got a wide variety of opinions about what's good and bad for the university, for education. A university is one of the few places you can disagree without being disagreeable nowadays. And I felt that while I really sympathize with many of the things they were protesting against, these students that were causing the upset, and I said, in some of these things, I'll go out there and carry a sign with you. If you're upholding the poor in the richest society on earth, or you're upholding minorities who are not getting their full civil rights, or if you're upset about the war, so am I, I'll be with you. But there are other people here who think differently and who want to go on with a normal educational procedure, And you can't be breaking into classrooms or burning buildings or doing that kind of thing, because that's against their freedom. And I felt in a way, as long as I was honest with them, but said, here's where you draw the line. You draw the line when you are impeding the rights of other people. Now, I'll uphold your rights to protest, but you've got to protest in a way that doesn't destroy the rights of other people to do what they legitimately want to do. I felt that's where the line ought to be drawn, and also to totally outlaw violence, which has no place in a university or anywhere else for that matter.
The demonstration that you had referred to before of the students who were protesting Dow and the CIA recruiting on campus, that was one of the very controversial issues on campus at the time. What was your defense for letting Dow, which was the manufacturer of napalm, and the CIA to recruit on campus?
Well, it was our feeling that Dow wasn't just doing one thing. And CIA had done some things that were, I had seen in my own life, were very important that no one else could do, including saving the life of Napoleon Duarte when he was about to be shot at dawn. And they stepped in and managed to stop that. I had seen the CIA do things abroad where at times there was no other agency that could find the facts on whether it was going to be a massacre or not, for example, in Haiti on one occasion. So it's easy to just say CIA is bad, but there are times when you need information and you need linkages where you can stop something bad from happening if it's going to hurt a lot of people. And I think at that point it seemed to me that if youngsters wanted to do that kind of work, that was their option. You shouldn't say to them you can't interview with them even, or even ask them what they're doing or why they're doing it, etc. It seemed to me it was a valid thing. We had probably every large corporation on earth coming in for interviews, and the students had the widest possible choice. But if someone wanted to work for Dow, I'm quite sure they would have said, I'll work for you, but I'm not going to make napalm.
One of the controversies on the Notre Dame campus, and this was a controversy on many campuses in the 60s, was the existence of ROTC training. And a lot of students at the time felt that the university campus was no place for a military training program. You defended the presence of ROTC on campus, although there were protests against it by your students. And I'm sure there still is an ROTC program there today. Why do you think the students were wrong in finding that incompatible?
Well, on this one, Terry, I believe that according to our Constitution, we're always going to have to defend the country. I mean, and there's always going to be an armed forces in this country. I don't think it has to be anywhere near as large as it is, if you ask me that, but in any case, there is going to be an armed forces, and that's a legitimate part of every country's self-protection, if you will, same as we have policemen on the beat. Now, I felt that having done a lot of work in the services, that you can always tell the quality of life in the service and the quality of your armed forces gets back to the quality of the officers. And it seemed to me that I'd rather be producing officers who were intelligent, who understood what peace was all about, who were against blind violence, who had ideals for this country and upholding of human rights, who were people of high integrity. I'd rather have that kind of person as in the officer corps than some guy from Podunk who never heard the word peace or understood what it was really about. And I would like intelligent, bright, philosophical, even theologically wise people conducting leadership in the armed forces. That's why I was for it. And I think it makes sense. I can understand people arguing against it. That's their privilege.
What do you think was the most difficult judgment call you had to make during the days of the student protests?
Probably when to go along and join them and when to say, you're out of line and we can't do this and I'm going to have to stop it.
And what do you think you learned from those years that you applied to quieter years on campus?
Well, I learned that leadership is terribly important. I remember calling the University of Chicago's president. His office had been occupied for 2 weeks, and finally they got through it, and the youngsters left, and they actually expelled them. But I said, how did you handle that? And he said, every morning I get up and said, what's the worst thing I could do today, like call the cops, and I didn't do it. I learned that pretty quickly.
Did you ever call the cops?
No, never called the cops, never prosecuted a student.
Why not?
And never lost a building.
Why did you draw the line against calling the cops? That was always a big issue on campus, whether it would be...
Well, I just felt we ought to be able to handle our own problems. We have our own internal security on the campus, of course, but they're not swinging clubs and things like that. And in a university, if you listen to people, if you're available, and I was always available till about 3 o'clock in the morning every day, and they knew they could get to me, and all they had to do is knock on the door and get in, so they couldn't say they weren't being heard. I disagreed with them time to time, but they always could be heard, and I knew where they were coming from.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Father Theodore Hesburgh. He was the president of the University of Notre Dame for 35 years. He retired in 1987. He's the author of several books, and he's just written an autobiography titled God, Country, and Notre Dame. This is Fresh Air. Theodore Hesburgh is my guest. I'd like to ask you about a stand that you took that was, I believe, controversial even when you left, you know, as late as 1987, and that was that you didn't move to divest the university of its holdings in South African-based business. A lot of universities did try to divest. What was your reason for not doing it?
Well, first of all, we did divest of about half of the holdings, I would say.
I see.
What we did, we said we will not do business with any bank who does business with the government of South Africa. That got rid of a lot of bank stocks and bonds. Secondly, I wrote a letter to every company in which we invested and said, are you following the Sullivan principles, which were against apartheid in the workplace? Are you treating all of your black workers in South Africa the same as you're treating your white workers? If they wrote back and said, no, we aren't, we divested, and we divested from a number of companies who wrote back and said we aren't. Those that said we're doing all of these things, I thought were a force for good in South Africa. They were giving an example that you could repudiate apartheid in the workplace and still have a successful business. And I thought that's something that deserves support, not just being automatically divested because someone said divestiture is a good thing to do.
In your book, you say that you offered mass every day except for one. What was that one day?
Well, in the old days, you're probably too young to understand this, Terry, or remember this, but in the old days, you had a fast from midnight. You couldn't even take a drink of water if you're going to say Mass the next day. And I was in a hospital most of the night because one of my friends was having a cesarean, and I baptized the child when it was taken by cesarean at 3 pounds, 8 ounces. And I'd been walking back and forth all night with a father, and I walked by a drinking fountain without thinking, took a drink of water, and that was against the rules in those days. Thank God we don't have that rule anymore.
When was it changed?
It was changed during Vatican Council II back in the 60s.
How did Vatican II change your life?
Oh, for the better. First of all, it became a lot easier for offering Mass in places that not necessarily a church. And I was always traveling all over the world and constantly finding myself in the boondocks where there wasn't a church. Secondly, you could say Mass at any time of the day or night, which was helpful. Thirdly, you didn't have that rule of fasting from midnight and saying Mass before noon the next day. In a personal way, I enjoy more saying my breviary, which is a prayer the priest says every day, about a half hour or so, in English rather than in Latin. It was briefed. It was made a little more brief. It used to be longer. But I just find I pray better in my own language than in Latin. Some people may dispute that, but that's the way I feel about it. I know Latin more than most people. Anyway, having lived pre-Vatican II and post-Vatican II, I find the church much more open, much more flexible, much more enjoyable, and much more, say, ecumenical, opening up to other peoples and other religions, and much more concerned with social justice in the world, and much more open to what's good in the world rather than say the world is totally evil.
A lot of nuns and priests have left the clergy because of the vow of celibacy, because they didn't want to uphold the vow of chastity. You say that celibacy has actually been very liberating for you.
That's right, Terry, and people might say that's silly, but it isn't. Let me just put it as quickly as I can. First of all, I think that celibacy is a gift of God, and it doesn't come easily necessarily. You've got to work at it, and you can't get yourself in all kinds of compromising situations if you're going to keep celibate, and you've got to be fairly careful of your own personal life. But granting that you do that, celibacy somehow makes you open to everybody because you're not committed to somebody. In other words, someone calls me in trouble in the middle of the night, I pick up and go. Well, you say a doctor does that too. Yeah, but he's got to explain why he's going and might say let somebody else do it. But the fact is that people are somewhat impressed, I have found in my own life, by the fact that you really do belong to everybody, that you really are celibate, that you don't have restrictions on doing anything that might be dangerous or demand a lot of your time or monopolize you at times. And people also have a certain confidence in that. I know this is going to sound curious, but I don't think it is. I'd say most of the work I've done around the country and around the world with other people, most of them aren't Catholic. And yet they're all married, and they all very often bring their wives to meetings. And they also ask me, the guys would, how come all our wives are very free with you and they seem to like you better than the rest of the guys around here? And I said, I think it's very simple. I'm not a threat to them. They know I'm celibate. They know that that I'm open to everybody, but they know I'm not going to play games with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a way they respected that in some way more than the fact that I offered Mass every day and that I said my breviary every day, although those in a sense were more related to my priesthood.
In your book, you write that you don't think you've had more than half a dozen sleepless nights in your life, and that at night you put your worries aside, you say your prayers, and you go to sleep. I think some of us are kind of constitutionally unable to put our worries aside at night. Do you have? How do you think you've been able to do that?
Well, first of all, I have felt that when you're in a position of responsibility, you have to make a lot of decisions. You're going to go crazy if you go back and try to remake them. So I try to live every moment for the moment and not worry about what I decided last week or yesterday or this morning, and not to worry about what I've got to do this afternoon and tomorrow and next week. As far as going to sleep, when the day's over, it's over. Now, I do one more thing. You ask for advice, I'll give it to you. But Catholics have a thing called the Rosary, which is a kind of repetition of the Our Father and Ten Hail Marys. And it's, in a way, almost like something in Eastern religions call a mantra. But in a way, saying the Rosary very often, like last night, I didn't get through it. I mean, I wake up in the middle of the night and sometimes, and there's the Rosary there, and I fell asleep. When I was a youngster, this is going to sound sentimental, but I'll say it anyway. When I was a youngster, my Irish mother used to say, just say the Rosary every night, and if you fall asleep, the angels will finish it for you. It's funny, but that's an Irish mother for you.
Well, Theodore Hesburgh, thank you very much for talking with us. Theodore Hesburgh's new book is called God, Country, Notre Dame. Next time, film producer Ed Pressman. He has three films out now, Reversal of Fortune, To Sleep with Anger, and Waiting for the Light. He's produced a diverse assortment of movies that include Conan the Barbarian, Badlands, and Wall Street. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Billy Whitelaw went to London in the 1950s, her working-class accent was considered inappropriate for a proper actress. She's one of the actors who broadened the scope of British theater. Coming up, Billy Whitelaw talks with us about the British theater, her collaborations with Samuel Beckett, and her starring role in the new film, The Craze. And this week, ABC is featuring a special that tests your knowledge of television. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, grades the test. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. U.S. officials met today with members of the U.N. Security Council to talk about a proposed U.N. resolution authorizing military force against Iraq. At issue is when the resolution should go into effect. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports from New York.
The Security Council is scheduled to meet on Thursday to vote on the resolution. The U.S., which presides over the council this month, says it has more than the 9 votes it needs for the measure to pass, but officials have kept up their lobbying among the non-aligned nations, hoping to get as much visible support as possible. The resolution authorizes member states to take whatever action is necessary to enforce the Security Council's resolutions against Iraq. In practice, that means force may be used to dislodge Saddam Hussein's troops from Kuwait. The resolution originally gave Saddam Hussein until New Year's Day to pull out, but sources now say the U.S. has agreed to push that date back until January 15th as a concession to some of the other members. This is Jim Zeroli reporting.
In Washington, the Army has ordered more than 10,500 more reserve troops to active duty. Since the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in early August, more than 93,000 reservists have been called to active duty. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein has ordered the release of 3 American hostages in response to a plea by their families who met with him today in Baghdad. About 900 Americans are still in Iraq and Kuwait, including about 100 held at security sites as human shields. Iraqi television quoted the Iraqi president as saying that his country wants peace. On Capitol Hill, hearings by the Senate Ethics Committee into the activities of 5 senators known as the Keating Five continue today. An aide to Senator Dennis DeConcini, Democrat of Arizona, was questioned this afternoon. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Lori Settlemyer, DeConcini's legislative assistant for banking issues, told the committee that she warned DeConcini that it could mean political trouble for him if he intervened on Keating's behalf with chief SNL regulator Edwin Gray. But, Settlemyer said, DeConcini thanked her for her advice and said he would go ahead anyway. Settlemyer is the author of a memo that describes what Keating wanted from regulators in exchange for leniency. Gray, who met with DeConcini and 3 other members of the Keating Five on April 2, 1987, claims that DeConcini offered him a deal based on the information in Settlemyer's memo. Gray is expected to be the next witness before the committee. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 6 points to close at 2,533.17. on volume of some 132 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin.
This is Fresh Air. Gangster movies often give us the chance to see offbeat performances by great character actors, but it's usually male character actors who star in the films. More often than not, the leading actress is the beautiful Moll. But in the new film The Craze, you can see the British actress Billy Whitelaw give a compelling performance as Violet Cray, the devoted mother of twin gangsters. The movie is based on the true story of Ronnie and Reggie Cray, who ruled London's underworld in the 60s and are currently serving life sentences in England. Billy Whitelaw is a prominent British actress who isn't as well known in America as she is at home, where she's received awards for her work in theater, television, and film. She had a close working relationship with the late playwright Samuel Beckett, who wrote several plays for her. American audiences probably know her best for her roles in The Omen and The Dressmaker. American actresses, especially character actresses, find that there are very few good roles available for them. I asked Billy Whitelaw if she's faced a similar problem in England.
Yes, I mean, I have been very lucky. I have played some marvellous roles in my time, but you're right, and it's exactly the same here. There seem to be far more exciting roles for actors than there are for actresses, I think by a ratio of 10 to 1. Why that is, I don't know. Perhaps it's because most of the writers are male. But you're absolutely right, and it is the same here. Most of the interesting leading roles in theatre and in film are male, but that goes right back to Shakespeare's time, doesn't it?
Now, I understand you had pneumonia during the making of the movie.
On the second day of shooting, I went down with pneumonia, yes, and I was in hospital for 2 weeks. And throughout the entire making of the film, I had a nurse with me from 6:30 in the morning to 8:30 at night. I got through it. It was all right.
Is there anything that you could use in the fever or the illness for the part?
No. No, unfortunately, absolutely nothing. It was because I felt very weak. No, it was just a question of getting enough stamina to get me through the day, to be absolutely honest. And the nurse I had with me was marvellous, and I had injections and tablets and inhalers and physiotherapy across my back. No, it was just getting through the day. And in fact, a couple of the scenes, I just couldn't make a couple of, I had to run down a street. And the actual giving birth scene, which obviously went on for more minutes than you actually saw on the screen, I spent a whole day shooting that, as that's always the way with films. You knock yourself out for 2 days and you see 2 seconds of it on the screen. Well, I found that very, very exhausting, and I had to stop part of the way through. Almost like giving birth in real life, perhaps. I don't think I felt quite as exhausted when I was actually giving birth myself. It was... I found the mock giving birth a little harder than actually giving birth.
You're all recovered, I take it.
Yes, I am. Thank you very much. Yes, I feel much better.
What's your interpretation of the mother in this story, of a mother who is very devoted to her two sons, and they're both gangsters?
Yes, the only way I could sort of get to terms with that half of Violet is to elect, as Billy Whitelaw, the actress playing Violet, I elected not to see that side of my sons, of the boys. I know it is possible, and God knows medical case histories are full of things like this, where you can elect not to be aware of something if what is staring you in the face is just too terrible for you to absorb. And I think she so loved these boys, I think she elected not to take that on board, not to absorb it.
Did you visit the Cray twins in their prisons?
No, I didn't. Reggie you can't visit because he actually is in a high security prison. Ronnie is in a psychiatric hospital, and he can have visitors. Ronnie said I would be more than welcome to go down and see him, but I professionally elected not to, because I didn't want to get the real life Ronald Cray confused with my theatrical Ronnie Cray. Do you know what I mean? I had in my mind, and actually in my working day, an experience of the two boys, Gary and Martin, who were playing my sons. And I felt, had I gone to see Ronnie, it would have become confusing. I'd have been putting Ronnie in Gary's place instead of acting with Gary.
You age around 30 years in the movie, and you age in increments. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not a sudden shift from one period to another. Mm-hmm. What was done for your makeup? Did you watch it getting put on? And I wonder what the experience was like of seeing yourself gradually age over 30 years.
Well, it actually doesn't happen gradually when you're sitting in front of the makeup. I've had it done before. It's not very nice. They certainly stretch the skin on your face, in between a finger and thumb, and stretch it, and then paint a rubber solution on it, and hold it until it dries. And just before it dries, it's a bit like putting what we call household adhesive on your face just before it dries. Then they squash your face up a bit like a prune, and it all sticks, and it's very horrible when it goes around the eyes. In fact, I requested that they didn't put too much around the eyes, that I was somewhat flattered that they thought I needed quite so much.
One of the things I like most about your performance in The Craze was your voice, the way you spoke. And I thought that there was something very musical about the way you spoke. And I'm wondering if I'm wondering if when you get a part, you almost see it as a score.
Well, I think if I'm doing an accent, I think all accents are musical. In The Craze, I don't use the same accent as I'm using now. I don't know whether you can tell the difference. I'll do a bit for you in Cockney. In The Craze, I talk like that, you know, and she's a Cockney. She comes from the East End, and she talks like that. Well, I don't talk like that. And whenever I do an accent, which I do very often, I think each accent has its own music. And I never worry about saying the actual words correctly. I think if I get the music of the accent right, then people will believe that I come from that part of the world. So in that sense, yes, you're right, Terry, in that sense, yes, I do tackle things musically.
Actress Billy Whitelaw is my guest. She stars in the new movie The Craze. We'll talk about her work with Samuel Beckett after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Actress Billy Whitelaw is my guest. You work very closely with Beckett. He wrote some of his pieces for you. What was the collaboration process like when you were actually working on one of his plays?
Well, it's a bit of a mystery, really. I know, first of all, we just got on well. I feel that I was just part of his ongoing process of creating a role. I just put myself totally in his hands and bent over backwards to try and do and achieve what it was he wanted me to do, and to sound and create the music that I thought he wanted. And we didn't intellectualize, we didn't analyze, we didn't dissect the plays and the dialogue. We went for the music, and I felt in my gut that if the music of the piece was right, it would work for him.
When you say that you worked almost musically, what does that mean?
We would just conduct each other. We would say, let's say, Happy Days or Not I, which is a sort of raging, rambling monologue of a vocal vomit, I call it. We would just sit and talk to each other and just recite the lines over and over and over and over again. And I would, whenever I went to the bathroom, whenever I went into the shower, I drove my family mad. I was just repeating this stuff over and over and over again. And if I would bump into Beckett in a corridor, or I would break into it and he would join me. In fact, both of us, practically every photograph he and I have had taken together, we're both of us conducting each other.
Did you sometimes feel that you almost had to rely on the music of the speech because the actual meaning of the speech was obscure?
I never worried about the meaning. I know it sounds dreadful, but I didn't, and Sam knew this. I felt what it meant. Intellectually, I didn't care what it meant. It's very arrogant of me to say that, but it's true. And he didn't seem to mind. I never knew what they meant intellectually, but I can feel what they meant. They're all about the story of my life, most of them. I mean me as Mrs. Everywoman, not me as Billy Whitelaw, because he's writing about Billy Whitelaw in particular. I recognised the condition, and that's what I wanted to come out of my mouth, and that was the battle.
When you started your acting career, I think you became known as one of the new working class actors who were coming along, and you made several of the realist working class films that became known as the kitchen sink style. Why was it such a departure to be a working class actress?
Well, we didn't have the theatrical tradition that you have in America, where you have sort of the group theatre and Clifford Odets and writers like that. We had a different tradition here of the classical theatre, and our popular boulevard theatre were people like Noel Coward and John Gielgud and writers like Terence Rattigan. And I'm now going to do what, as a child, when I heard proper actors and actresses, which I didn't think I was, they seemed to speak something like this. Their voices were sort of rather what we call here South Kensington. Now, I didn't speak like that at all. I came from a part of England where there... Could you tell the difference in my voice there?
Yes, I could.
Or not?
Yeah,
you could.
Definitely.
Well, that's how proper actors and actresses spoke. And until we lot from the north of England, most of us invaded London. Unless you spoke like that, you didn't. You weren't employed unless you were employed as an actor, playing funny little common secretaries or funny little waitresses or the leading lady's funny little friend.
Were you afraid that you wouldn't ever be able to break in because you were not proper in your speech?
Well, no. I mean, I had an inferiority complex, which was as tall as the Empire State Building, because I came from a North Country working class family. But when I came down to London, which is the time that a whole lot of people came down and things changed, Joan Littlewood was changing the face of the theatre here, and Albert Finney was breaking moulds here. And we all seemed to arrive at the same time. And I suddenly found the way I spoke, which was a broader than I'm speaking now, I had a North Country accent, was fashionable.
Did you ever end up doing Shakespeare in the classics?
I did. And for someone who came from where I came from, I ended up playing Desdemona opposite to Laurence Olivier at the National Theatre. So that was quite a jump for me.
Did you feel that you had to do a different kind of accent to do Shakespeare?
Martita Hunt, who is a marvellous, marvellous actress. I remember her saying to me once, "My darling girl, are you aware that when you go on the stage sometimes, you put on a funny voice? You don't need to, you know." And I took cognizance of that. Yes, I was putting on a funny voice, you're right, Terry, but... I don't think I did, eventually. I don't think I do now. I mean, the way I'm speaking now is me. It's me. It's a bit... It's the edges are around it, but that is my own natural voice.
The two recent movies that I've seen you in, The Craze and The Dressmaker, are both set during World War II in England. They're both about women keeping families together without adult men, without fathers or husbands around, or at least not around very much. Not around much to, like, really matter a lot. Both of these movies are in a lot of ways about the ties between women. What was your war experience like?
Horrible. I was what's laughingly called a war baby. Now, I was in Coventry during the war. I'd be six. And actually, they've just celebrated now 50 years of the dreadful Blitz of Coventry, 3 days, which I remember as though it were yesterday, when Coventry was annihilated. It was bombarded. I can still hear it in my head. Yes, I was bombed during the war. My father was still at home because he was hard of hearing. He was deaf. But there weren't very many men around. They were all away fighting.
What was the effect of the war on your family?
It is something that I always get a bit astonished when people say, oh, they were marvellous days and the great camaraderie. I thought it was awful. It made me a great pacifist. I thought people really shouldn't do this to each other, you know. My sister was injured in the bombing, and I, I didn't like seeing people being wounded. I didn't like being frightened night after night with all this stuff dropping out of the skies. And it does get me a bit angry when I hear people flippantly say, oh, go and drop bombs on them or nuke them or whatever, you know. It's not very pleasant when you're on the other end of it, you know. But it was something that I wasn't. We all had to go through here, and a lot of people have been through a lot worse. But not nice.
You are a very well-known actress in England. You're less familiar, I think, to Americans. Would you like to do more American films? And have you tried to have more of a presence here?
No, I haven't. I must say my family and my home has always come first, and I can't imagine a situation where that will change. I creep out and do a bit of work from time to time, but I'm not career orientated in that way. I don't sit down and plan my career, what am I going to do next. If something comes along and I'm interested in doing it, I would do it. And if it doesn't, I'm very happy to potter around.
After having worked with Samuel Beckett for so long, do you feel that there's things that you used to do with him that you now apply to the way you interpret roles in movies?
Yes, actually, my husband says to me, will you stop tackling every role as though you were doing a one-woman Beckett monstrosity? By that, I mean a sort of a mountain of a role. I'm apt to bring a sledgehammer sometimes to a role when it doesn't really need it. And I've got to stop doing that. I really have got to stop doing that. That's only my own anxiety. I'm so used to girding my loins to tackle a very difficult role that sometimes I will have to say, I say to myself, well, it doesn't need all this energy from me to do this. I can just relax, and it's not as hard as I think it is. With Beckett, it was as hard as I thought it was.
Maybe that's what comes through in the role that makes your performances so special.
Well, it's not from lack of doing my homework, I must say. It's made me, I sort of lock myself away in a room and work like a demon when I'm asked to do a role. I mean, far more than is very often necessary, but perhaps I'll get over that, I hope.
Billy Whitelaw, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you.
And Billy Whitelaw stars in the new movie The Craze, and she spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is joining us from Washington, D.C. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we're still following the president's efforts to get a resolution through the United Nations allowing for the possible use of force in the Middle East. And we're looking at two elections in Poland, where a dark horse candidate got into a runoff with Lech Wałęsa, and in England, where Margaret Thatcher has stepped down and will be replaced by one of possibly three men, and we don't yet know who her replacement will be. We also have some music on the show. T-Bone Walker, he was an electric guitarist from Texas. He's been dead for 15 years, but there's a retrospective of his music newly available.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Wednesday, ABC is replacing its low-rated lame duck series, Cop Rock, with a special called The Tube Test. It's a show that tests your knowledge of television, but TV critic David Bianculli gives The Tube Test a failing grade.
I'd like to describe The Tube Test in one word, but I can't decide between infuriating and putrid. Infuriating because whenever TV takes a look at itself, whether it's in a serious documentary or a silly little quiz special like this, it blows the opportunity by being superficial and condescending. Putrid because, well, because of everything. Start with Alan Thicke, who hosts, and who bombards viewers with a succession of moronic questions. Who is Alan Thicke? Is he A, the star of Growing Pains, B, the former star of Thick of the Night, the worst late-night talk show until Rick Dees came along, C, the former producer of Fernwood Tonight, or D, all of the above? The answer's D. And that question, dull as it is, beats anything on the tube test. Apparently, the producers of this special didn't want to discourage viewers by making the quiz too tough. But viewers who recognized the show's cameo guest stars, people like Tiny Tim, Dwayne Hickman, and Jim Nabors, have already passed the toughest test. Some of these questions, I mean, come on. Name the character who wears a beat-up raincoat? Identify the theme song to Bonanza? For 1 point each, name the four monkeys? Gee, that's a tough one. Weren't they Mickey, Mike, Millie, and Vanilli? And even when the show stumbles on a halfway decent question and actually has a chance to say something interesting, it doesn't.
For 4 points, which series featured TV's first interracial kiss? Was it Benson, Hotel, Star Trek, or Miami Vice? The correct answer is Star Trek.
That is the right answer, but it's incomplete and a little less daring a TV landmark than the tube test would have you believe. Yes, Captain Kirk and Lieutenant Uhura did kiss on Star Trek, but only in a scene where both of them were being manipulated, against their will, by mind-controlling aliens. That's the only way Star Trek got it past the timid network censors at the time. But does Tube Test mention it? The answer is A, no. Even its research is sloppy and incomplete. Listen.
Hi, I'm Dwayne Hickman. On The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, my chief rival for the affections of Thalia Miniature was a character named Milton Armitage. Milton was rich, spoiled, and arrogant. Unfortunately, he was also handsome and dressed to kill. For 4 points, who played Milton Armitage? Was it A, William Shatner, B, Troy Donahue, C, Warren Beatty, or D, Jack Nicholson?
You know, I always hang my clothes 6 inches apart so that the materials don't rub together. You know, many a wardrobe has been ruined by materials rubbing together.
How many suits would you say you had?
Oh, well, I'd have to check. I mean, I really couldn't say offhand.
Oh, me.
All I can tell you is that my closet is 16 feet long.
Oh, God.
The girl in that scene, another first-year Dobie Gillis regular, is played by Tuesday Weld, but the tube test doesn't even bother to identify her. I guess it's because she hasn't been in a hit movie lately, so why bother? Why actually be interesting when you can spend the entire hour being infantile and insipid and uninspired? I hate this stuff. How can TV expect to be taken seriously when it treats itself so moronically? A well-researched, well-written tube test could have been informative and even provocative, as well as entertaining. Instead, it's none of the above.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Ron Barron, and Dan Lachlan. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Reversal of Fortune, Wall Street, and Badlands are just some of the films produced by Ed Pressman. On the next Fresh Air, Pressman talks with us about making movies. And Carol Barkalow tells us about being among the first women to graduate from West Point and going on to command a company of men. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.